Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Okay, tonight is our final class. For those of you regulars in attendance, this has been about 20-25 weeks of our Great Controversies in Jewish History class. I'm very excited to bring our course, the third year in our series, to a close. I congratulate you all on having been here. We have discussed the Sadducees and the Karaites and Christianity and its origins to the Greeks, to the distinction between the... We've been discussing the Ashkenazim, we covered the Sephardim, the Muranos during the Spanish Inquisition, covered the Rambam and his opponents, the Kabbalists versus the Rationalists. We've discussed the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, the Jewish Enlightenment movement and the Reform movement and the responses to those. We've discussed Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz, the Zionists and the anti-Zionists. Last week we did a Yom HaShoah and the case for a separate day of mourning versus the case not to have a separate day of mourning. And tonight we get to conclude all of the Jewish history controversies. Now we've covered them all. There is no more controversy in Jewish history that we have not covered with Yom HaAtzmaut, which is being celebrated in Israel as we speak tonight. And part of the central elements of that, the tefillah, the prayer that was established for that, so the phrase Reishit Tzmichat Gulasenu, the beginning, the flowering of the redemption that we've been discussing throughout this entire period. The treats in the back are sponsored by Beth Jacob in honor of all of you in completion of this course. It has been for me an absolute pleasure being involved in this course with all of you throughout this entire period, and hope it has been as enjoyable for all of you as it has been. And now we have the task of choosing our next year's course. I, of course, am open to suggestions and looking forward to hearing from you what it is you'd like to learn about next year. Tonight, we have a treat as we bookend our course. We began this course, those of you who remember, Rabbi Beryl Wein was here from Israel to open up our course discussing Jewish history and controversies. So our pattern is to bring in great scholars from Eretz Yisrael to teach our classes, and tonight there's no exception. We have a very special treat. Rabbi Dr. Avraham Steinberg is here from Eretz Yisrael, who is quite an impressive figure. For those of you who were at the Atlanta Scholars Program at St. Joseph's Hospital yesterday or this afternoon, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg is the Associate Clinical Professor of Medical Ethics at Hebrew University, Hadassah Medical School in Yerushalayim. He has written over 30 books, 242 articles, given over 3,000 expert witnesses, very much focused on medical ethics. His bio is rather impressive, and I'm not going to go through the entire thing with you here tonight, but what we do have a treat to hear from is another book that he's written, which is about this topic of the founding of the State of Israel and the prayer that was created in its founding, and this particular phrase. And it is with great pleasure that I offer you Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. There are books being sold by Rabbi Steinberg on the side as well. For those of you who are interested afterwards, you can mosey on over and purchase one of those. And without any further ado, I present you with Rabbi Dr. Steinberg.
Good evening. Like the Darshanim say, before I start talking, I want to say a few words. So first of all, really it's a great pleasure for me and an honor to be in this community. I have been discussing a few issues here in various avenues and found a very warm and welcoming community, and it's really a pleasure to be here. Second point, as we are talking now, in Israel it's already Yom HaAtzmaut, but here it is still Yom HaZikaron, and I would like to dedicate the words that we will discuss this evening in memory of the soldiers and of the terrorist victims that have perished in Israel for the state to be established and being kept. Tehi nishmatam tzura b'tzura chayim. I want to explain what I'm not going to talk about before I'll start talking. So I'm not going to talk about the significance of the day that is called Yom HaAtzmaut from a halachic point of view. In the sense that, is it a holiday? Does it make a halachic difference? Do we say Hallel with a blessing or without a blessing? Do we bless Shehecheyanu? Do we bless Shasa Nisim Lavoteinu. There are a lot of halachic questions around the fact that it is a kind of a Yom Tov, although by all means not a day that we don't work on, but like Purim, like Hanukkah, you're allowed to work, yet it has a status, a halachic status. It has the halachic status of a holiday, Purim and Hanukkah, and yet we can work on that day, but we either read the Megillah or we say Hallel, and there are all kinds of other mitzvot, the Rabbanan, that are attached to the day. The question is, how do you envision the day of independence from a halachic point of view? So that is something I'm not going to talk about. It's being discussed at length. I would like to spend the time now on the prayer for the state of Israel, which, although was created in 1949, first time published, it's not so long, yet already there is a historic debate who composed this prayer. And there are different viewpoints, who was the author of this prayer, and recently we could establish it with certainty that the following happened. Rabbi Herzog, who was the chief rabbi of Israel at the time of the establishment of the country, he was the one that wrote the tefillah, L'Shalom HaMdina. But he wanted the approval of other of the rabbonim at the time, and the poetic aspect, the stylish aspect, he wanted to improve as well. So he sent his handwritten Tfilah L'Shalom HaMdina, which we have found recently. He sent it both to the Sephardi chief rabbi, his colleague, Rabbi Uziel, and to Shai Agnon, who was a big poet. He is a Nobel Prize winner and had a lot of understanding in writing a rabbinic way. And Shai Agnon has rewritten, handwritten the whole tefillah, because in those days there weren't computers, you couldn't do cut and paste on the same page. So in order to make changes, he didn't want to do it on the handwritten letter that he got from Rav Herzog, so he copied it and made the changes. And that was preserved longer than the original of Rabbi Herzog. So therefore the assumption was that he was the one who composed it, because it is available to see a handwritten Tfilah L'Shalom HaMdina by Shai Agnon with a few corrections. But the truth of the matter is, as I said, that Rabbi Herzog wrote it, sent it to him, he rewrote it in his handwriting in order to make the changes that he suggested, and that came back to Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog got also the corrections from Rav Uziel, and then there was a formal chief rabbinate decision that will be the format of praying for the state of Israel. Now again, I'm not going to talk about the entire tefillah. It's a very interesting concept of how to compose it. It is a little bit different than Hanoten Shu'al HaMlachim that is said in the diaspora for the rulers of the different countries, but the concept is very similar. Now interestingly, the origin to pray for the country where you live in, where you stay in, has already a biblical origin and a Chazal origin. Yirmiyahu Navi already told the children of Israel when they went to the first diaspora that they should pray for the country where they are. And Chazal in Pirkei Avot said that you have to pray for the country, because without a ruling order, Ish et re'ehu chayim belao, one would kill another one because there will be no order. So the fact that there is a ruler is important to keep peace of the citizens, which will be for the benefit of the Jews as citizens in this place. Interestingly, that throughout the history, we have found ancient manuscripts of this type of Anoten Shualam Lachim, of this prayer, which apparently in that format was composed in Spain for Ferdinand, who was the ruler that rejected the Jews from Spain. And for him, before he did what he did in 1492, they composed a prayer for his sake. So that is very interesting. Also, there is a prayer found in communist Russia for Stalin, who obviously killed as many Jews probably as Hitler did, and yet there was said a prayer in communist Russia in those days. And even more surprising, until 1933, there was a prayer said in Germany, even when Hitler already took office. So it's to show that it doesn't matter who the rulers are and how bad they are and how bad they behave, the dictum is that you have to pray for the peace of the land, because overall it does good. The interesting question is it only for a foreign ruler or also for a Jewish ruler? In other words, do you pray this prayer only when you are in the diaspora for kings and rulers in countries, or do you pray it for the rulers of Israel in Israel? And the answer is yes. You pray for any kind of ruler, and no matter how good or bad he is, as long as he keeps order. That is the rule. He has to keep order, and that is what we are praying for, and therefore that is a halachically an accepted concept. So again, I'm not going to talk about the details of that entire tefillah and why we should or shouldn't say it. I want to talk only about three words mentioned in the tefillah l'shlom hamdina, which is not mentioned in any other known form of prayer, and that are the words Barech et Medinat Yisrael Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. We pray that God should bless the state of Israel, which is the first or the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. So is it indeed, are we living indeed now in a period which can be called Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu? That is the main debate. Now, interestingly, there are those who reject this concept, and we'll go into some details why they reject it. But by rejecting these three words, they reject the entire tefillah, which doesn't really make sense, because the rest of the tefillah are psukim, are verses from the Bible, are statements from the Talmud. No one in his right mind will say that something is wrong with it. So why not say that? So actually what you could do is say the tefillah without the three words. Bless the ruler so that they will be making peace, and there will be kibbutz galuyot, and there will be peace in the land of Israel, and keep the people happy, and so on. What's wrong with saying that? So there's certainly nothing wrong in saying these parts, of the major parts of the tefillah. The debatable part, and I'm talking only halachically, I'm not going into politics at all, and that's not my expertise to speak about politics, but from a pure halachic point of view, is it or isn't it Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu? So as usual, and as you know, there's hardly anything in Jewish law that is not debatable, and those few things that are not debatable are not practiced, because no one knows about them. If everyone agrees, so probably we don't have to do it. And I already mentioned in some of the meetings here when we pray in the morning, we add, before we start the main prayer, we add a chapter for Mishnayot, for Masechet Zvachim, Eizu Mekoman Shel Zvachim. And we read the whole chapter of Mishnayos. Why was this chapter chosen out of the entire Shas? There are so many chapters in Mishnayos, we could have said many others. Why this? And the answer is that that's the only chapter in the entire Shas Mishnayos that there is no machloikas in the chapter. So we want to start the day with something that there is no machloikas. Although in the Gemara on that chapter there is already machloikas. It doesn't go easy, but the Mishnayos part of this chapter is the only chapter in Shas that there is no machloikas. That is to show that all the rest, there's nothing, there is no machloikis. So, obviously, it doesn't surprise us that the words Roshit Zmichad Yulateinu are disputable. And that's fine. That's how most of the halachot are looked at. Now, you would think there are two solutions. Either you say it or you don't say it. But, as Jews have it, we can find a third solution. And that is to say it in a different version, to say it differently. And I'll come to it at the end, if time permits. A minority of people who want to say it but have some doubts have changed a little bit the wording, and they are satisfied with that way. So there are three ways to decide whether we should say, not say, or say it differently. Now those who oppose it, who say that we cannot say Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu because it's not Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. That's not how the redemption should look according to our sources, according to this opinion. And what is different there? So first of all, the major halachic dispute against saying that it's Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu is that the country was established as a sin against an oath that HaKadosh Baruch Hu imposed on us, and that is based on the Gemara in end of Ksubas in Daf Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us to take an oath on three issues. One is shelo ya'alu b'choma, which means that we shouldn't get together to fight the people who live in Israel in order to conquer the country. Or another interpretation is we shouldn't come as a big group, the knufia, as a big group to Israel, which will show that we are trying to conquer the land of Israel. The second one is shelo yimredu ba'umot. We shouldn't rebel against the countries that we sit in. We shouldn't come now and say we are going now to fight the United States of America, we the citizens here, because we have to go to Israel and conquer Israel. So we are now rebelling against the country we sit in. So we have a vote and an oath not to do it. And the third one is that the goyim shouldn't coerce us too much. They're allowed to cause us a little bit trouble because that's the diaspora, but not too much. So two of the oaths relate to the Jews and one to the non-Jews. That is based on a few verses in the Song of Songs in Shir HaShirim, that it said three times, Hishbati etchem benot Yerushalayim. I made an oath towards the children of Jerusalem, and it says three times. So say Chazal, each time is one of the three oaths that I just mentioned. So those who oppose the concept that it's Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu say, how did we get the country to become an independent country? We got our hundreds of us going into the state of Israel. We fought against the citizens in Israel, and we got the country. So we went against what we were not supposed to do by the oath that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made for us. So since the country was established by sin, according to this understanding, therefore we cannot say it's Rashid Smichat Gulateinu. That's not a way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to redeem us by a way of a sin. That is one issue. The second issue is that if you look at some of the verses in the Bible and some of the Talmudic sources, and particularly in Rambam, you will find that the order of redemption is that first all of the Jews will repent and become observant Jews, and only later will come the redemption. And since currently the situation is not like this, not all Jews have yet repented, and not all Jews are yet observant Jews, so anything that happens beyond this point is not a redemption, because the redemption has to be preceded by a repentance which didn't happen. The third point is that the order of redemption that the Rambam writes in his Hilchot Melachim is very different than what we see now. What do we see? We see that we have a country, but the rulers are not the rulers descendant of King David. And according to Maimonides, at the time of redemption, the king should be a descendant of King David. Secondly, the temple has to be built before Mashiach comes. And only after these two happen, that there is a king, a descendant of David, and the temple was built, then will be Kibbutz Galuyot. Then all the Jews from all over the diaspora will emigrate to Israel. What we see today is a reversed situation, that we see a great emigration. We have many, many Jews coming from all over the world, but there is no temple yet, and there is no ruler, a descendant of King David. So that is a reversed way, which according to Maimonides is not what should happen. The fourth issue, according to those who think that it is not the beginning of the redemption, is that the final redemption is supposed to come from heaven, not man-made. And since the country was redeemed by men, by people, that is not what has to be if we are talking about heavenly redemption. And the fifth point is that the rulers in Israel are non-observant. The whole state of Israel is not built on halachic parameters. Some say that Israel is the 51st state of the United States. It's just another secular state that behaves very similarly to many other Western societies. That is not what redemption is about. Redemption is about establishing a Jewish halachic state, which is far from that. So the state doesn't operate as a Jewish halachic state, and the rulers are not people who observe Jewish law, and therefore that is not what is imagined as the final redemption. So these are the points against accepting the fact that we are in a period of Rishit Tzmichat Geulateinu. So it sounds like we are in trouble, right? That there are very strong points to say that we can't say Rishit Tzmichat Geulateinu, because it doesn't fit the plan, the program that we know from the sources. So now let's look at those who say that it is Rishit Tzmichat Geulateinu. And they say the following three principles, which I'll fill in with some examples. First principle is that we are living in a period that can be the time of Mashiach. And I'll explain it in a minute. Secondly, we are living in a period where the negative signs of Mashiach time did occur. And thirdly, we live in a situation where many of the positive signs of the final redemption have been established, and we see them with our own eyes. So if you combine the three, you will find that indeed it can be the beginning of the redemption, but we'll have to answer the counterpoints that I just stated. So starting with the time, according to Chazal, the world will be 6,000 years. 2,000 years were from Adam HaRishon until the Torah was given on Har Sinai. These are called the period of Tohu, period where there was no Torah in the world, where people did whatever they wanted. The second 2,000 years from Matan Torah, 2,000 years, and in a minute I'll tell you when the 2,000 year begin. This is the period of Torah. That is the period that Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah, the Sanhedrin was, the Shas was established, Tanoim, Amoroim, and we live according to what happened in those middle 2,000 years. And the final 2,000 years are called by Chazal Yemot HaMashiach. This is the period when Mashiach can come. And according to the Abarbanel, the meaning is that Mashiach cannot come prior to this. And that was his big argument against Christianity. Because the one that established Christianity was in the 2,000 years of the middle period, where by definition can't be a Mashiach. The Mashiach can only come in the last 2,000 years. He discusses, interestingly, what happened with Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kochva. Rabbi Akiva lived in the middle 2,000 years, and yet he thought that Bar Kochva was Mashiach. And he was mistaken. Bar Kochva was killed, and he didn't turn out to be Mashiach. So the Abarbanel asks, how could this mistake happen? Let's say that Rabbi Akiva had a mistake on the person, that he thought Bar Kochva is someone that can be the Mashiach, and he was wrong. But he was wrong in principle, because the period wasn't the right period for Mashiach to come. So that's a whole discussion. But certainly, the last 2,000 years, any time within the last 2,000 years, Mashiach can come. Now, according to the Zohar, the middle of the last 2,000 years, which is Hey Alafim Taf Reish, which is in the general calendar 1840, that is the period where from then on, if Mashiach didn't come up to now, there is a certainty that he will come between that time and the end of the 6,000 years. And obviously we live beyond that period. It's a very interesting historic discussion if anything happened specifically in 1840. So far I don't think anyone could find something that was significant enough to make this year such an important year. But it's not the year per se, it's the period from that year on. And since we live in the period of the last 2,000 years, and not only the last 2,000 years, but beyond 1840, so we live in a period where Mashiach can come. So at least we are not wrong in the concept that it can happen. Whether it happened or not, we can debate and we'll see later, but at least we are in the framework of what can happen. Now, Chazal have described positive and negative events at the time of Yemot HaMashiach. Yemot HaMashiach is a period at which, at the end, Mashiach himself will come. But the whole period is a period of Yemot HaMashiach. So there are a lot of negatives in this period. The major one is significant mishappenings to the Jewish people, to the degree that many of the Amoraim said, Yeti velo achmine. I'm praying for Mashiach to come, but I'm praying not to be at the time when Mashiach will come. Because it will be so bad for Jews when he is coming that I want him to come, but spare myself from that period. And I think it's very obvious that what happened in World War II, there was never a period so bad to the Jews as what happened in World War II. So to say Yeti velo achmine, he should come but I shouldn't see him, was very appropriate to say that no one would have wanted to live in this period. That is called Chevlei Mashiach. Chevlei Mashiach, from a Hebrew understanding, Chavalim are the pains of a woman giving birth, which are excruciating pains. I can't testify how bad it is, and probably I'll never be able to do it, but women here and elsewhere know that the whole pregnancy can go very easily, but at the end, before delivery, there comes a period which is very difficult, very painful. So the same with Mashiach. There can be a whole period that is okay, but before he comes, there are chevlei Mashiach. There are pain of a delivering woman towards the end. And obviously, I think everyone would agree that that happened. Now, in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Tzadizayin, Tzadichet, there's a whole host of events and behaviors that many of them we can testify that are happening. And to the degree that the Chofetz Chaim, who lived before World War II, he died before the war broke out, he said that he lives in a period of Chevlei Mashiach, because the signs that he sees, what Chazal said, the negative situation, is occurring in his lifetime. And that was before World War II. So if it was true in the 30s when he lived, it is certainly true after he died, that all these signs, the negative signs, are signs that have occurred. Now, there are positive signs. Positive signs in a sense that when the period of Mashiach will come, certain good things will happen to the Jewish people. The biggest one, and the one that is mostly discussed, is Kibbutz Galuyot. It's the fact that Jews will come from all over the diaspora back to Israel. And that phenomenon that we see with our own eyes in the past 5-6 decades is really of historic magnitude, because there was never a period in Jewish history that so many Jews got up from wherever they are and went to Israel. It didn't happen during the First Temple, it didn't happen during the Second Temple, it didn't happen during Kingdom of Israel, whenever there was, there were never so many Jews in Israel as we see them today. So that is a real Kibbutz Galuyot that I think no one can have a mistake that it's happening. What I said earlier, and I'll come back to it, is the order right? Is the Kibbutz Galuyot that we see in the right order of the final redemption or not? That we said no on one side, and I'll show you that it can be that way as well. But the fact that there is such a kibbutz galuyot that was never ever in the history of Jews, we live in this period, so we don't realize it. But looking from the side, there's no nation in the world that for 2,000 years was expelled from their country and came back with so many numbers and re-established the country. There's no such nation. The Babylonians, the Assyrians, the ancient Egyptians, the Greek, the Roman, all disappeared once they left the country or were forced to leave their country, never came back. What you see today, Egypt or Greece or Italy, has nothing to do with the ancient people that lived there in the ancient history. Whereas we as Jews were expelled for 2,000 years and yet re-established the country. So that is something that I think is very clear. Another clear thing that, again, people look at it routinely, don't pay attention to it. In Yechezkel it says, "V'atem harei Yisrael anpechem titenu uferiechem tisu lami Yisrael ki kervu lavo." The prophet Yechezkel says that the mountains of Israel will be filled with trees and with fruit, and there will be greenery all around at the time of redemption. And whoever visits Israel, and certainly whoever lives in Israel, sees very clearly that wherever there are Jews living in parts of Israel, it's green. Wherever there are non-Jews living, it's a desert. And the demarcation is very sharp. And it's something that it's almost unimaginable. How could it be? It's the same soil, it's the same land, and yet Jews living up to this point, it's green, and Arabs living from this point on, it's a desert. And that, Chazal say, "En lecha ketz megule mize." When this is happening, you can't imagine a final redemption greater than this fact. Just this fact, that there will be greenery in the country where up to now it was a desert, that is a sign of redemption. It's a physical sign, and it certainly appears. Moreover, the Ramban, Rabbeinu Bechaya, and others point to the fact that Israel does not accept any other nation but Jews. And for the 2,000 years that we were away from Israel, the land of Israel was a desert. People lived, all kinds of people. In the later centuries, they were Arabs, but they were before Turks and others who lived in Israel. No one has made Israel a green place. It was always a desert, because the country does not accept any other nation but the Jews. And that said the Ramban many years before he saw even how Israel looks. He came at the end of his life to live in Israel, but that was his interpretation of Vahashimoti et Mikdashechem, be a Shmama. Shmama is a desert. And it's amazing to think about it, that for so many generations the land of Israel was a dry land, was a desert. And once the Jews started to come, the first thing that they did, they became farmers. And they were very successful farmers. And all of a sudden, Harei Yisrael anpechem titenu, we saw leaves, and we saw trees, and we saw greenery. So that is a very significant sign. Next, on the positive side, is that the Rambam paskens according to the Shita in Shas, "Ein ben haolam hazeh leimot ha-mashiach, ela she'abud malchuyot bilvad." The only difference between olam hazeh, how we live, and the period of Yomot HaMashiach, is the only difference is that Jews will be a free nation. They will not be under another nation. "Ein ben haolam hazeh leimot ha-mashiach, ela she'abud malchuyot bilvad." Now Israel, certainly you can like her or don't like her, but it's a free country, and there are no rulers over Israel except for the citizens of Israel. So according to the Rambam, that by itself creates the period of Yemot HaMashiach. You don't even need any other site. If we go according to the Rambam. Some wanted to say that we are not as free because America dictates all kinds of things and we are not such a free country. But I think the latest period has proven that it's wrong. America wanted a certain way and we rejected it. Kerry is very angry at Israel, but yet we didn't accept what he wanted. So it is a free nation that takes care of its own needs, and certainly there is no Shubud Malchuyos, and therefore, by definition, it is the period of Yemot HaMashiach. There are other signs which we can go on, but I want to mention something which we may think that is irrelevant, but as you will see in a minute, it's very relevant. And that is the Balfour Declaration, the San Remo acceptance of this declaration by all nations, and the UN resolution in 1947, which, as we'll see in a minute, it sounds like a political event, which it was, but it has a significant halachic interpretation for our purposes. So before answering the other opinion, there's another point, and that is that the redemption of Israel is described in the Yerushalmi like Ayelet HaShachar, like the rising of the beginning of the day. The day doesn't start right away with midday. The sun goes up slowly and gradually until it becomes the middle of the day and the sun is in its full power. That is called Kim'ah Kim'ah, slowly, slowly. So Chazal say that the redemption of Israel will be Kim'ah Kim'ah, will be gradual. In other words, as opposed to some who feel that the redemption will be an instant, one event, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do one thing and all of a sudden everything will be different, that is not how Chazal envisioned the redemption. The redemption is very gradual. So some of the signs of redemption can appear, and others maybe will appear a little later. And a little later in historic character can be 100 years or 200 years, but it's the beginning. And that's why it was carefully worded, Reishit Tzmichat Geulateinu, the beginning of the flowering of the redemption. We're not talking about the final stage or the end of it. We are talking about the first or initial gradual situation. So now we are left with the question of the three vows, of the three oaths, that supposedly we were not allowed to do all of this. We weren't allowed to fight the countries there. We weren't allowed to rebel from where we were. And the goyim weren't allowed to overdo what they did to the Jews. So those who do not accept that it's Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, as I said earlier, claim that this is something that was done sinfully and therefore we can't relate to it. But those who see all these signs and feel that it is at least Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu deal with the three Shvuot in the following way. First of all, it is a statement in the Talmud, indeed, but it's not the halacha. None of the poskim has accepted it as a halachic rule. It's an opinion in Shas. There are thousands of opinions in Shas on different issues, but what binds us is not an opinion in Shas, but a halacha. Was it accepted as a ruling? The answer is no. The Rif, the Rosh, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch don't mention it at all. It's not mentioned in any of the poskim. So from a pure halachic understanding, The three Shvuot are a concept, are an opinion, but they are not the rule that the Poskim say. The one that is very strong opposing the whole notion of the State of Israel was Rabbi Yoelish Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, who wrote a whole book which he called Ma'amar Shalosh HaShvuot, the statement of the three vows. And in this book he tries to point out that it is a halachic issue, and the fact that it wasn't mentioned by neither of the major poskim, he claims, is because it was irrelevant. In the days of the Rambam, of the Rosh, of the Rif, no one in his right mind thought that he's going to conquer the state of Israel. All the Jews were in terrible conditions. Anti-Semitism was all over the place. So because it wasn't a relevant halacha, they didn't mention it. But it's not to say that they didn't accept it as a halachic ruling. That is very difficult to understand, because indeed the Shulchan Aruch brings only those rules that are applicable in our days. He doesn't discuss issues that are not applicable. For instance, in Shulchan Aruch there are no rulings about Beit HaMikdash, about Tuma, about Tahara, because it's not applicable. We don't use it today. But the Rambam covers everything. The Rambam discusses everything that has a halachic meaning, whether it is applicable or not. So if he discusses how the temple, how the Beit HaMikdash will be built exactly, the measurements of it, certainly has nothing to do with our days, because there is no Beit HaMikdash. Why shouldn't he mention this if this is a halacha? That really is very difficult to understand. Indeed, the Rambam mentions it once in all of his writings, not in Mishneh Torah, not as a halachic ruling, but in his letter to the Jews of Yemen. It's called Igeret Teiman or Igeret Ashmad. The Jews in his time in Yemen were under persecution, and there were Mashiach Sheker, and there were all kinds of trouble to the Jews. And the Rambam wrote a very famous letter to the Jews of Yemen to to encourage them to feel good with themselves despite all the persecution that they are suffering. So there in this letter, which is a letter of encouragement, he says, don't worry, the Golus will still go on, but at the end everything will be okay. And indeed, we don't want to do now things that are bothering the system because of the Shalosh Shvuot. But that is not a halachic statement. That is a philosophical explanation of the situation. Everyone agrees that you can't use it as a halachic source. Now, let's go one step further. Let's say that it is the halacha, despite the fact that no one of the poskim mentions it. So then, there are several limitations to these vows. One is that it was limited in time. The Etz HaChaim, Reb Chaim Vital, the Talmid of the Ari HaKadosh, writes in his book that this vow was effective for 1,000 years only. Now, how do you calculate 1,000 years? When was this vow said? It is written in Shir HaShirim. So one interpretation is that Shlomo HaMelech discovered this vow. So if you calculate 1,000 years from Shlomo HaMelech, we are far beyond that period. So it is not effective anymore. Some say that Shlomo HaMelech couldn't make a vow for generations on his own, so probably the origin is earlier, maybe even Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, and he wrote it in his book, but really it's earlier. If so, then the 1,000 years are even earlier, so even that doesn't apply. So the time has passed even if we would want to accept it. But the major point is, before the major point, as I said, there are three vows there. Two applying to Jews and one to non-Jew. There is a halachic rule that if two partners make a vow to each other, if one is not fulfilling the vow, it becomes void for the other one as well. If it is a mutual vow, then both have to keep it. If one doesn't keep it, automatically the other one is exempt from it. Now, since the three shvuot have two components, two for Jews and one for non-Jew, and the non-Jew certainly went way above the vow because they really caused trouble to Jews much more than any expectation, so they didn't keep their part of the vow, therefore our part of the vow is also void. So that is a halachic way. But the major point that most of the poskim agree is that the vow is only against the will and wish of the nations. Once they agree, there's no vow. And the proof to it is by Cheney that Jews came from Babel, from the Golus, by the permission of Koresh, why wasn't it considered against the vow? They weren't allowed to go, they were after Shlomo HaMelech. The vow was already there. How could they come and build the second temple? The answer is that they didn't do it against the nations, they did it with the permission of the nation. Because Koresh, who was the ruler of the area, gave them a permission. So the permission has a halachic significance to take away the meaning of the vow. So the Reb Simcha, Reb Meir Simcha, the Or Sameach, the Meshech Chochma, lived in the years of a Balfour Declaration, and in 1920 in San Remo, the world organization that preceded the United Nations had a vote whether to accept the Balfour Declaration as a universal declaration or not, and it was voted in favor. Said Reb Meir Simcha, you can think it's a political issue that some countries have voted. I'm telling you it's a halachic position, because once they agreed, there are no more the three votes, the three oaths, because the agreement is really something that takes it away. Now, if that was true in 1920, it was so much more true in 1947 when the United Nations established the country of Israel by the approval of all the nations at the time. So that has a halachic significance to take away the vow. Well, first of all, even if you would accept your position, the vote was still a vote, and the nations gave a permission. It was a formal decision. How did they, why did they do it? There are always interests, so there's never something that comes out of the blue. So the end was that there was. But secondly, what they did, what the Jews did, is only to the mandate of the British. They didn't do anything wrong to the Americans or to the France or to any other nation. Why should they agree to it? The British could say, you forced us out of here, let's say. But the agreement was of all the nations. It had nothing to do. I mean, maybe the interest was not to be bothered with the Jews, let them have a country and they should be quiet in the world. It doesn't matter. But the bottom line is that they agreed. And I think that is a very powerful statement. Now, coming back to the argument that the order of the redemption is different than what the Rambam says. The Rambam has a certain order. We said first the king coming from a descendant of David, then establishing the Beis HaMikdash, then Kibbutz Galuyot, And prior to all this, tshuva. And that is not the order that we see. So since we don't see it, so probably that is not what is happening. That is the argument of those who hold that what we see is not a redemption. So first of all, the Rambam's position is a minority position. In most sources, either they say that we don't know how the order will be, or they say that it's totally independent on redemption. On repentance. The redemption is totally independent on repentance. So the Rambam's position is a minority position. Why should we take his position? But to add to it, the Rambam himself, and that is something that is very, it's a puzzle to me how it was overlooked. The Rambam says, "Kol elu advarim v'kayotze bahen lo yeda adam me'achiyu atchiyu shedvarim stumim hem etzel haneviim gam hachachamim ein lahem kabbalah bedvarim haelu." The Rambam, after he says the order that he thinks will be at the final stages, ends the chapter by saying, all what I told you, no one knows if it's really so. No human being knows how it will really be. We are not prophets to say it. Not only don't we know how it will be, but even the prophets didn't know, because in the prophets there are contradictions how the order will be. And even the Chachamim, meaning Chazal, don't have a straight answer how it will be. So the Rambam had an idea based on some sources that it may be that way. That doesn't mean that he ruled that it has to be that way, otherwise it's unacceptable, because he himself says that no one knows how it will be. So therefore the order really is not something that we can count on and say, because it's not according to the order, therefore we should disregard it. No one would know, and when it happens, if we have enough positive signs that this is the situation, then we should follow it the way it is and the way we see it. Now, the question whether the final redemption will be natural or an S coming from heaven, again, there are sources that say so, and there are sources that say the opposite. And again, we come back to this general statement of the Rambam, that no one knows how it will be until it will be. When it will be, we'll see if it's so or not. But to say a priori that only one position counts and the other position is disregarded, that can't be. And interesting, the Leshem Shvo Ba'achlama, that was the grandfather of Rav Eliashiv, who was a big mekubal, in his book Leshem Shvo Ba'achlama, he writes that what he sees, and he lived before the country was established, what he sees is, in his opinion, Atchalta de Geula. That is how Geula should be, according to what he understood from a Kabbalah understanding. So what we see up to now is that, on the one hand, there are those who hold that the three vows are still effective, and therefore something wrong was done by establishing the country, so therefore it can't be the redemption. On the other hand, we saw that either it is a statement that has no halachic bearing, or it has changed because time has passed, it's beyond 1,000 years, or most importantly, it is done by agreement of the countries and not by rebellion against the countries, and therefore it has nothing to do with the three shvuot. Coming to the last argument against the acceptance of the period as being the beginning of redemption, is that most Israelis, most probably Jews in the world, and certainly the leaders of Israel, are not observant Jews. They are doing things which halachically are wrong. And how come HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes the whole process of the final redemption by messengers who are doing wrong? From a halachic point of view, it's inconceivable. That's the argument. The answer to it is that this is how it happened all through Jewish history. When we were redeemed from Egypt, the first redemption. So it says, "V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim," and the Gemara interprets "chamushim," one of five, and some say one of 50, and some say even one of 500, meaning that one of five, or one of 50, or one of 500 were redeemed. All the rest were killed in Egypt during the plague of darkness because they were sinners. So only 20%, the best out of all these calculations, were observant Jews in our standards at the redemption of Egypt, the first big redemption. Most of the nation were non-believers, so they were punished. But now those who were redeemed, the 20% or the 1% or the 0.5%, whatever calculation we make, very shortly after they got the Torah, what did they do? They did the worst thing possible. They worshipped an egel, right? So they weren't the biggest tzaddikim. They weren't the Gerer Rebbe or Avel Yashiv, right? And yet they were redeemed. Now let's look at the second temple, the redemption at the second temple. In the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, most of the Jews didn't want even to come to Israel. They stayed in Babel because it was good there. It was good economically, it was good socially. They didn't want to bother to come to Israel. Who came to Israel? Those who married out, who had Nashim Nochriot, those who didn't keep Shabbos in Israel. In Ezra and Nehemiah, he yells at them that they are Mechal Shabbos, they shouldn't do it. Most of them didn't know anything about what the Torah says. Ezra had to teach them. And they were the ones that were redeemed from the second Golos. Now, if you look at the whole historic period of Jews in Israel during the First Temple, most of the Shoftim and most of the kings, both of Israel and of Judah, were sinners. Achab was a murderer. And yet Eliyahu HaNavi was running before him to give him respect because he was the king, no matter what. But who was he? He was a murderer. In many instances, there was flourishing adultery. So there was a situation that most of the historic period of the nation of Israel was ruled by people who were unworthy to do it. And yet, they had the status of kings. They had the halachic status of king. So the fact that today we see that the rulers are not observant, comparing them to rulers in ancient times, they are tzaddikim. None of them kills, none of them rapes, none of them worships Avodah Zarah. I mean, they don't do terrible things. They are not as we would like them to be, but still they are not as bad as them. So that by itself, to say that that is a reason not to accept that this is the beginning of redemption, is very hard to say. Now the Netziv has a very interesting point, and when the beginning of the Jews coming to Israel, then obviously there was the state, but they started to come to Israel, and he was told that most of those who come to Israel are non-observant. So how come you are letting the non-observant to do the redemption, to start the process of redemption? So he said, you want to teach HaKadosh Baruch Hu who to be his messengers? if they are the messengers of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so he has the reasons why he chose them and not me. But who are we to tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you are wrong by choosing these messengers, you should have better ones? Yes, we would prefer better ones, but that's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it. So who are we to say differently? So all this, I think, points to the fact that there are enough reasons to accept the concept of Rishit Tzmichat Geulateinu. And again, it's Rishit. We are still far away from the real redemption, but it can be a beginning. And there is a very interesting, and I don't know how even to word it in a way, in a respectful way, there is a book called Kol HaTor. Kol HaTor was written by one of the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. There is a debate, and he quotes the Vilna Gaon on the final redemption. What will happen then, and what will be the signs, and why? We are talking about the Vilna Gaon about 250 years ago. We're not talking about very current issues. There is a debate whether everything written in Kol HaTor are the words of the Vilna Gaon himself, or this Talmud added of his own a little bit here and there. We don't know. But be it as it may, one statement there says that when the redemption will come, one of the signs will be that the observant Jews will not believe that this is the redemption. And he says that is a sign. If you'll find a period where all the signs are that it is a redemption, and the observant Jews reject it, you can be assured that this is true. That's what he says. So whether he said it or the one who wrote it said it, but it's an interesting observation. So this is the second position. And I told you that there is a third position. The third position says, we hear those who say it can't be the beginning of the redemption. Makes sense? We hear those who say it must be the beginning of the redemption. Makes sense? So what do we do? You know the story about someone who comes to the rabbi and has complaints against his wife, and he says so and so, and he listens. He says, you seem to be right. Then the wife comes and has complaints against her husband, and she claims and says, he says, you know what, you are right. So the Rebbetzin says, how can it be? Either he is right or she is right. So he said, you know what, you're also right. So sometimes when you have a misunderstanding, it's hard to decide between the parties, because all makes sense as if. So they say the following: maybe it is the beginning of the redemption because of all that we have said, but maybe not. And the biggest proof to this position is the story of Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kochba. Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kochba is Mashiach. Rabbi Akiva wasn't a simple Jew walking in the street and having an idea. He was the greatest Jew after Moshe Rabbeinu, because the Gemara says that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to heaven, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him that there is someone who will know the Torah better than he. And that was Rabbi Akiva. Already in Moshe's time, Rabbi Akiva was created to be his successor in knowing all the Torah. So such a great personality decided that Bar Kochba is Mashiach, and it turned out that he was wrong. So apparently, if he decided that Bar Kochba is Mashiach, he had all the right signs to decide so. He didn't decide so just because he liked Bar Kochba as a friend. He decided because there were signs that, according to his understanding, fit Bar Kochba, and yet he was mistaken. So this third group says, let's say that you are right. All the signs are here, and it can be. But maybe it will turn out to be wrong. Who knows? So therefore, we are not sure. So because we are not sure, they say the following. All the rest, which is the major part of the Tfilah L'Shalom Amdina, has nothing to do with what we are talking. All the rest are, as we said, verses and chazal and asking for good things for the country and for the Jews and for the soldiers and so on. Why not? That is not a problem. But to say that it's Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, we have a doubt. So they add one word. Shetehei Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. So they say, Barech et Medinat Yisrael, Shetehei Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. By that, it's a double meaning. It's either Barech et Medinat Yisrael, Shetehei Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, as we see it now, or Shetehei Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu in the future. Now it's not yet, but in the future it will be. So by just adding one word, they get out of the trouble to make a decision whether this one is right or that one is right, and yet they can do all of it together. So this is some of the ideas around it. There are obviously many more that I don't have the time to go into more detail, but that is how we view this phrase, Shetehei Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. However, everyone agrees that the maximum we are at is the beginning. We need to do an effort to bring it to fruition, to continue the process. Now there is a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Be'ita Achishena. At the time, I will hasten it. Which is contradictory. Either it's a time, or it's hastened. What is it? So the Gemara says, Zachu Achishena. Lo Zachu Be'ita. If they are worthy of, then I, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, will hasten the redemption. It will come quicker. But if lo zachu, if they are not worthy of, nevertheless, it will come, but it will come when the time will come, which is a set time a priori, which we said will be within the next few years, within the 6,000 of the existence of the world, it will come. And it will come no matter how we will behave. That is what Chazal says. It can come bedor shekulo zakai, and it can come bedor shekulo chayav. It can be a generation that all are rebbes and dayonim, and all are tzaddikim, and it can come in a period where all are not worthy of. Yet, if the time will come, it will come. Says the Vilna Goen that there is a third option here. According to Chazal, it's either Achishena, if you behave correctly, it will come quicker, or Be'ita, it will come when I designed it a priori, when you don't behave well. But, says the Vilna Goen, that sometimes the Be'ita can be quicker. In other words, it can be the right period, but the period is long. And within the right long period, it can come quicker or later. In other words, the Geula could have come already 1,000 years ago, because we are in the second thousand of the 2,000 years of Yemot HaMashiach. It didn't come. We weren't worthy of. So it wasn't quicker. But now that we are at a period that is closer to the time which will come anyway, but it can take many years, that we can affect by making it quicker. And some of the prescriptions that Chazal gave to the nation of Israel are things that, according to Chazal, can make it quicker. I think the first and foremost one is unity. If we are united, that can bring the Geula. That's a Beferish Posuk, Ba'asiti otam legoy echad ba'aretz, u'melech echad yeh lechulam, ve'lo yechatzu ot l'shtem amlachot, and then the Geula will come. Unfortunately, we are today in a situation where unity is very far away from Jews. Everyone is fighting with everyone, no one agrees with anyone, and we are very far from there. If we could work on a way that despite disagreements, we are still united, and the disagreement is in principles but not in people, that is a prescription to make the Geula come faster within the time. We are not worthy of it, but it will come anyway. Another one, and there are many like this, another one is Shabbos. The Gemara says, "Ilmale meshamrim Israel shtei Shabbatot keilchatan miyad negalim." If all of Israel would keep two Shabbatot as has to be done, the Geula will come right away. And the Yerushalmi has it that even one Shabbos is enough. So if we all the Jews, will keep one Shabbos correctly, the Geula will come. That's what Chazal said, and we believe in what Chazal is saying. Obviously, repentance, as we said, may be a condition for redemption to come. But even if it's not a condition, it is certainly helpful for the redemption to come. So if we will repent on what we are doing wrong, and everyone is doing something wrong at some point, if we look at ourselves and we'll understand that we did something wrong and we'll repent, and everyone will do it, that is a prescription for the Geula to come soon. And hopefully we'll be worthy of it, that we'll see the Geula, the real Geula, and it will be accepted by everyone, although this condition is very problematic in our days. Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.